Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. It's good to have you here with us on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbite. You're listening to Soundbites here on WEAA FM 88.9 FM, the voice of the community out of Baltimore, Maryland, broadcasting to the state and on Delmarva Public Radio on the Eastern Shore, throughout Delmarva, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM for our weekly look at food, our food system, and our environmental future. Before we jump into our conversation, we'll remind you, I think we found the patron saint of soundbites. This weekend, they'll be celebrating St. Bridget's Day, B-R-I-G-I-T, of Kildare, this Irish saint. She is the saint of babies, blacksmiths, cattle, chicken farmers, children whose parents aren't married, children with abusive fathers, children born of dairy maids, dairy workers, fugitives, infants, midwives, milkmaids, the poor, poets, as I said, poultry farmers, poultry raisers, and watermen. So what better saint can we have than St. Bridget, who can honor soundbites? She was born a slave in Ireland, as the story goes, and was also taken from the great Celtic goddess Bridget, who was the goddess of earth and farming and raising what comes up, and which is why they gave her that name. Many stories about how she came to be, but we do know she was born a slave of some kind and became this patron saint, St. Bridget. And so we'll just name her now St. Bridget, the patron saint of soundbites. And today on Soundbites, we are going to cover a lot of territory. Later in the program, we're going to be talking about this new project on the Eastern Shore in energy program management that came out of Washington College. We're going to be having a debate with Nathaniel Johnson and Tom Philpott on GMOs. But we begin with Cleo Braver. Cleo Braver is owner of Cottingham Farms in Easton, Maryland, and she's developing what's known as a food hub. We had some months back a conversation with Red Tomato, which has built this huge food hub in New Jersey, parts of New York and New England. Cleo Braver has an idea, a dream, and a sense of what this can mean for being transformative in our world. And Cleo, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Good morning, Mark. Glad to be here.
Glad you're here. And folks, you can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner. And there's a chorus in the background. I like choruses in the background.
I just tapped him on the nose. So you'd be corporate.
So we'll see if he responds to my questions. So, Cleo, let's start with describe, first of all, this notion of a food hub. I remember in a meeting once that we had together, talked about this transformative idea of what you thought could happen, what it could mean, and I never heard it kind of expressed in such a detailed, passionate way. So describe for our listeners exactly what you're talking about.
Well, what I'm talking about, what a lot of folks are really talking about across the country, and just the other states are a little bit ahead of us on this, is basically building a physical site that will permit the aggregation of the product, whether it's sustainably produced vegetables or grass-fed animals, or organic grains or at least GMO-free grains. It'll permit the aggregation of the product that's produced by a number of small and medium-sized growers and producers, so that it can reach more of the market, so that the producers can reach more of the market, so there's a more sustainable, even flow of healthy foods for our community. Right now, Maryland is a like most states, really, we're a net importer of most of our food. The tomato example, 90% of our tomatoes come from Mexico and Canada, yet people think of Maryland as a great place for wonderful tomatoes, and it is, but there just needs to be more of them. So we can be replacing the imported foods that are coming out of Florida and California, if we're lucky, and Mexico and Canada if we're less so, with food that's grown by Marylanders on Maryland agricultural land. And it's a very nice sized economy that's sort of waiting to be born here, and we have all the elements here to do that. We have some of the largest pieces of contiguous undeveloped land mass on the East Coast. We have young people who are very interested in farming, who are locating to other states that are a little bit more advanced, I think, than we might be. And we have great access to demographic centers where this aggregated food can be sold. We have a lot of institutions here. I think probably haven't seen the formal numbers, but I think we have a lot more institutions of higher learning and hospitals than the average demographic centers have. But we have a lot of institutions that can be buyers of Maryland-produced food rather than food that's imported from other jurisdictions or other countries.
So, you know, when we have a farming system in this country, but a farming system in this state, a farming system where the part of where Soundbites emanates from and where you live on the eastern shore and throughout the state that is kind of primarily built around corn and soy, primarily built around large in kind of industrial farming of chickens and some other animals. So you know, and we're talking about something very different here. When you talk about how that could shift, I mean, I've heard people in this program say before that if Maryland's agriculture system was different, we could not just feed the state of Maryland, we could feed much of this region or help feed much of this region. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so, but what does that mean? I mean, especially in the context of what the reality is at the moment.
Well, I think it means, you know, from my vision here, I mean, it sort of means two things. I think there's definitely a way for local farmers who, you know, already exist on the Delmarva Peninsula to participate in this healthy economy. It could be a very real alternative in these times of shrinking grain subsidies. Now, I know that those grain subsidies may be converted to other programs like insurance and the like, but I think an awful lot of farmers are interested in moving. They're looking to see what is organic grain production involved. Can it be successful? And there's a number of large organic grain producers on the Eastern Shore, and they're wonderful models. The Fries, the Masons, and I think they can participate by converting to organic. They can participate by going into on some of the parcels that they own or farm for others, pastured animals, to the extent that they don't want to. And want to, you know, stay with the corn production, that's fine. The conversion to this kind of agriculture doesn't really take that much acreage at all for vegetables. So it's not like corn and soy farmers are going to be wholly displaced. They won't. It'll be quite a long time, if ever, that that happens. And that's not what we're looking to. We're looking to provide an alternative economic reality with a healthier economic reality, I think, for our CAFO, current CAFO operators and corn and soy growers. But so I think there's going to be some conversion of some of those fields. So, for instance, you know, we have a very typical farm, 156-acre farm, 100 of it is tillable, three fields. You know, you could convert one field of 15 acres to pasture chickens, or convert one field to four hoop houses and some field crops. And the vast majority of, you know, the tillable acres that remains could still be, you know, corn farmed if that's what, you know, what the desire is. Alternatively, we're bringing, or additionally, I should say, we're bringing in new young farmers. You know, you go to the Pennsylvania Sustainable Ag Conference or the Future Harvest Conference, Chesapeake Alliance Sustainable Agriculture Conferences, and there's thousands of young people who are looking for land to farm. Well, there's thousands of attendees, and there's hundreds of people looking for land to farm. And so it'd be nice if some of those folks located to Maryland, which after all has a much more temperate climate, well, it did until the polar vortex. It has a much more temperate climate, you know, generally, and an extended growing season. We have a much longer growing season, or had, than New England and most parts of Pennsylvania. So it can be much more attractive to young farmers. So we have everything in place. You know, we're the land of healthy living. I mean, pleasant living. We're a great landing spot for emergent young farmers. So I see it as being partially a conversion from folks who are right now doing other things, and also an influx of new young farmers who want to participate in this. You can grow an awful lot of food on a pretty small parcel of land. But it's the buffer strips and the managed intensive grazing that starts to take up acreage. But vegetables themselves, it's phenomenal how many vegetables can be produced on how few acres. Elliot Coleman, there was just a story in the New York Times, Elliot Coleman, who's like the father of winter farming to us growers, you know, grosses, and I can say this because it's publicized in the New York Times article, he grosses $150,000 on 1.5 acres. In Maine.
In Maine.
Yes. So when I say this is an economy waiting to be born, I mean this is an economy waiting to be born. It can be fairly large. You know, it all comes down to management. Obviously, he's as good as it gets as a vegetable grower manager, those are not average numbers. But it can be that when it's done on a small, very intensive scale.
So how would this work here, though? I mean, what does that mean in terms of, I mean, how would it literally work? So you have hundreds or dozens or hundreds of smaller farmers,
mm-hmm.
Aggregate their food, can label it the way they want to, send it through this hub, it goes out. A, my question is, how many people are talking about that feeding? And B, does that mean that food that's healthier becomes more affordable for working class people in this state who really can't afford that food?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. The whole notion of the hub, as I see it, is, you know, it's not a standard for-profit organization that wants to send its owners on long vacations and have all kinds of dividends. It's an L3C, a low-profit limited liability corporation, which kind of combines the best of the nonprofit and for-profit world, which frankly should be one world anyway. I mean, you know, my personal view is, you know, a corporation needs to do well and sustain itself and economically and you know, create a living wage for the folks that work for it. But it also has to be pretty, you know, mindful of what its place is in its community and what it's doing. I mean, is it coming in and putting out four other like purveyors of the same service out of business, or is it coming in and meeting an unmet need? And for me, I just see this as a completely unmet need. But what this organization would do would come in, and it would be economically sustainable, and it would pay people well for the work that it does. But it would also take some of those, you know, the profits, and it would be reinvesting them in the farming community by providing even more services that it might not provide initially. And it would also be, among other things, you know, subsidizing the cost of the product. So those communities that can't afford the $4 a pound organic heirloom tomatoes can enjoy them as well. But there's also going to be more room to lower prices than they have prices lower than they otherwise would be, because it is not an organization that is looking to accumulate retained earnings. It is an aggregator, so it is going to be creating economies of scale. So you're not going to have this profit retention. You're going to have economies of scale that are created. You know, I give these examples, you know, it costs just about as much for me to buy 3 pallets of tomato boxes as to ship an 18-wheeler full. Then why don't I buy an 18-wheeler full? Because I can't afford an 18-wheeler full of boxes. And even if I could, I wouldn't have a place, an air-conditioned space, a mouse-proof space to put them if I, you know, building to put them in if I could.
And the hub would do that? The hub would allow that to happen?
A hub is going to have storage. They're going to have storage from everything from tomato boxes to beet crop, you know, to root crops that have to be stored. These are things that individual farmers, you know, all can't afford to build on their own farms, or to have one that's 32 degrees, one that's 45 degrees, one that's 55 degrees for the sweet potatoes after they cure. You know, these are things that take a lot of money. So it would be basically aggregating for the purpose of, you know, packing for some, it would become an already packed. To aggregate it, to, you know, to label it with the hub label, but it's also going to be farm identified, obviously, because we want to push the names of our producers, and traceability is going to be, you know, required anyway. And then it gets, you know, put on reefer trucks, freezer trucks, you know, regular Sprinter vans, and gets transported. So all of these things where you're scaling up, whether it's combined storage, whether it's one full truck going to Woodbury instead of my truck going with my things to Woodbury or Whole Foods, you know, whether it's shared inputs, lowered input costs because you're buying your compost together, buying your seeds together. You get huge price breaks on seeds when you buy bigger quantities. An average grower can't take advantage of those bigger discounts.
So a place like Red Tomatoes, two quick questions before we have to go. One is Red Tomato, I mean, what they do is they've aggregated all these farmer things from several states, and they end up now taking these to supermarkets that would be equivalent to what are the names of supermarkets? The equivalent to like the Giants of Baltimore or the Shop and Save of Baltimore and the Eastern Shore, the Food Lions that are so prevalent down in Delmarva. I mean, that's so is that what we're talking about too? I mean, you're actually getting to places where
a little more than Red Tomato. I mean, Tomato is a nonprofit aggregator,
right?
But they don't actually take possession of it. They kind of like aggregate the products across growers after the order is received, and they do a lot of help services and coaching services for their producers.
No, but they also have trucks that deliver things all across this multi-state area now.
Yeah, there's so many different models of food hubs. The vast majority of which have been formed in the last few years. They go from just simply being an aggregator. Some of them are virtual aggregators. They do it online, on the internet. There is no physical space.
So how do you see it happening here? What is
here,
the plan?
I see a physical space. I think the Eastern Shore agricultural community is such a part of this area that there should be a physical space. It needs to be visible because, you know, public awareness of the impact of food choices is so great. You know, when you choose what goes in your mouth, you're deciding whether there's an animal that's suffering or whether it's a free-range animal. You're deciding whether atrazine is sprayed. You're deciding whether the foods come in 2,000 miles or 1,500 miles, as is the average, versus a 200-mile food shed, which is what this would be. This would distribute within 200 miles. You're deciding what your landscape looks like, you know, when you choose what to eat. So public awareness is a big part. So there'd be a physical space. There'd be, you know, a space for education, for farmer training, for, you know, eventually in subsequent phases, you know, community kitchen where people, where producers and the public can make value-added products. You know, it's either really a physical place where families can come together around food again. They can do their shopping. They can learn about food. It's something that's sorely needed. If there's one human activity that justifies learning more, I think this one is it. You know?
Well, we will continue this conversation.
You're all engaging it.
Yes, I think this is really important about this food hub. We're going to be creating these conversations between you and others and the farmers we met the other week from Future Harvest CASA, who are the original farmers who started that organization in Maryland. They talked about this is one of the next steps that has to be made, how we come together. I think this is an institution whose moment has come, and I think that it's great to have you on the air with us, some of this, Cleo Braver, and we look forward to really pursuing this in greater depth. Cleo Braver is owner of Cottingham Farm in Eastern Maryland, organizing the prime mover behind organizing a food hub on Delmarva as this kind of new way for Maryland to go. Cleo, thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, Mark. We'll talk again.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a very brief break, we can take a very break, and then we'll come right back with our next part of our conversation, debating on GMOs. Stay. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on 88.9 FM WEAA, the voice of the community, and Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on their banner. Here on Soundbites, in the Mark Steiner Show, we're about to have a conversation about GMOs once again. The other week we talked to Nathaniel Johnson, who is a food writer for Grist, who teaches at the University of California Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, author of All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keep Us Healthier and Happier. And when he joined us last, we talked about GMOs and thinking that we're making too much of this argument against GMOs. We'll talk about why. He was joined also by Tom Philpott, who joins us here often as a commentator, Mother Jones, food and agricultural blogger and columnist and co-founder of Maverick Farms in North Carolina. And Nathaniel and Tom, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Great to be here.
Nice to be here.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888 with your thoughts. This is a huge topic that people are concerned about. Write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also log on to our Facebook pages, Mark Steiner Facebook pages, or tweet us at Mark Steiner. So let's just jump right into this. This is really a fascinating discussion, I think. Let me pick up where we left off the last time, Nathaniel Johnson. I mean, one of the points we're making, that I want Tom to come back into this as soon as we lay this out, one of the points you were making the last time we were on this air was that you thought that the GMOs that we have at present have been shown not to be dangerous, that we're making too much of that, and that this is going to be part of the world landscape. So describe what you were saying again for our listeners, and I'll let Tom come right back in.
Well, I think there's fairly wide agreement. Probably Tom and I agree that the ones that we have right now are not dangerous, or at least, you know, you can never prove a certainty, but these are not so risky that they keep me up at night. Definitely not as risky as, you know, my car or that my water heater will blow up in the middle of the night. But they're perhaps not, you know, not the greatest thing in the world either. There's often this line that's sold to us by the industry that we really need these things to save the world. I'm really interested in looking at the individual GMOs, the organisms themselves, and saying, okay, well, you know, what exactly is the risk of this precise plant, and what exactly is the benefits, and making a determination about that, you know, in specific, rather than you know, the entire GMO debate, taking that on all at once.
So, Tom, I mean, I've been interested in following this kind of conversation you've had on your site as well in response to some of the stuff that Nathaniel Johnson has been writing, and so I think there's a real difficulty here in some ways, because one of the things that I know that Nathaniel asserted when we were talking together before was that this is akin – that we are probably more upset about GMOs because of the battling around large corporations of industrialized agriculture, and that this argument could be displaced.
I mean, definitely. The rise of GMOs in the mid-90s definitely added sort of another corporate layer and kind of an intensification to agriculture. Suddenly, farmers weren't just buying seeds, but they're also sort of renting this technology trade. They were paying this technology fee on top of the actual seed. And I think that one question that has to be asked is, in the 16 or 17 years that we've had these crops in the market, and they've grown incredibly fast in a few commodities like corn and soy and cotton, what benefits have come our way? And I think Nathaniel and I would probably disagree on a lot of that. I think a lot of the benefits have been way overblown. And I think that the second question that has to be asked is, what is on the horizon? What wonders are awaiting us from these crops? And I think when you get into that question, I think things get really murky from the standpoint of the industry's promises. There's just an article in Wired that talked about how in its vegetable division, Monsanto has basically completely turned away from genetically engineering technology, And the reason cited partly is consumer backlash. People don't want to directly eat genetically engineered tomatoes or lettuce or things like that. But another strain of the article also argues or shows and quotes Monsanto people saying this, that the technology doesn't work very well for things like improving flavor or, you know, engineering more phytonutrients in their broccoli and things like that. That traditional plant breeding with a couple of high-tech techniques involved that aren't transgenic work a lot better at these things. And I think that really gets to the core of this argument that I think that Nate and I agree that that GMOs don't matter that much because the promises have been way overblown. And we're starting to see the company acknowledge that. Where we don't agree is, I think, I don't want to speak for Nate, but within those commodity crops, I think within corn and soy and cotton, especially the first two, the grip over those crops is so tight and it's such a lucrative market that I think we're going to see the company coming out with more of the same traits and using it sort of its market dominance to keep these traits in the marketplace without adding very much. And in fact, I think taking us down an extremely destructive road when it comes to the use of agrochemicals on these fields. And we're talking, you know, corn and soy, I think to most Americans, seems like this very abstract thing, but it literally covers more than half of our farmland. I think I've done the acreage calculations, and it's around 200 million acres, which is about California is about 100 million acres, the entire California. So you're talking about huge swaths of land covered in these crops, and the traits that are on the ground now are not doing us any good, and I don't see much coming down the pike in the Monsanto pipeline or in the industry pipeline. So it's going to change that.
Well, we have to get a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to come right back to Nate Johnson to pick up on the thoughts that Tom Philpott just had. As we look at GMOs, we want to explore, can they feed the world? We want to explore the ideas of as pesticides and herbicides, what that effect will be. And it's part of this discussion we're having because people are worried about these kind of new technologies and why they don't want them in their food. But does it also have to do with who owns our food and the seeds that grow our food? Is this part of the conversation? Stay with us as we explore the debate over GMOs, as Maryland and many other states are debating whether or not to label for GMOs. Stay with us. We'll be right back on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will... Where have all the young girls gone? They've taken husbands, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn? Where have all the young men gone? Long time passing.
Pete Seeger passed away, and we had a dedication to him earlier in this program, and remember him in this next hour as well with the songs that he gave us. We are here with Tom Philpott, Mother Jones food and agricultural correspondent, co-founder of Maverick Farms, North Carolina. Nathaniel Johnson is a food writer for Grist. He teaches journalism at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, author of his latest book, All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Keeps Us Healthier and Happier. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages, Mark Steiner, or tweet us at Mark Steiner here on The Mark Steiner Show for sound bites, 410-319-8888. So here's the question. I mean, Nathan Johnson, when we read about GMOs, at the beginning, the kind of primary idea was where to be involved as a herbicide or a pesticide, whether, you know, it's on the eucalyptus trees or potatoes or whatever that is. And then people write about that in turn yields pests that are that can withstand what's put down. So stronger things are made, and then more people have to use Roundup or whatever it is to kind of kill what's going on. This is what people think is a dangerous cycle when it comes to GMOs.
Yeah, and it's not just GMOs. I mean, it's the, you know, it's all of agriculture. And this is what we've been dealing with since the dawn of agriculture. With GMOs, we've certainly been, we've seen this exact cycle with herbicides and herbicide-resistant plants. And we're getting new herbicide-resistant plants soon that are resistant to new herbicides, and you know the cycle will continue. We have seen, I think, as a result of GMOs, use of less toxic herbicides, but we've seen a huge increase in the overall amount. When you look at insects and insecticides, I think you see something a little bit different. I mean, we have seen some insects gaining resistance to genetically modified crops. But not everywhere. There's been some places where people have been able to really be smart about the way that they plant these and keep that resistance at bay. And there's some insects that haven't gained any kind of resistance at all. So because of that, we've actually seen a big decrease in the use of insecticides. Some of the really worst, most toxic broad-spectrum insecticides like organophosphates have really just dropped through the floor because of that.
Tom, did you hear that?
I did.
Okay.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that are going on there. One is that I don't think that you can sort of assess the fall of organophosphates directly to the rise of BT, you know, BT corn, for example, because
I wouldn't put it as a sole cause, but there's, well, it's, you'd certainly say that it was related. There's one part of the.
It's possible, but I think what I'm sure it played a factor, but I think what has really taken the place of organophosphates is the rise of neonicotinoid pesticides. And, you know, that's one of the things that is kind of odd about this these technologies is that, you know, the BT technology works pesticides, sort of engineers this toxic gene of this pesticide called BT into corn and cotton. It doesn't work for soybeans. But at the same time, you've seen a large rise in seed treatments. These crops are treated at the seed factory with neonicotinoid pesticides, which is a broad spectrum pesticide. You've seen the rate of usage of neonicotinoids skyrocket in the era of BT corn and cotton, and the ubiquity of this pesticide, because it's not just in corn and cotton, but it's also in soybeans and alfalfa and other crops. There's strong evidence linking it to the demise of honeybee populations, and so. I'm not sure about the overall numbers, but when people say that BT corn eliminated organophosphates, it's not quite right. If you look at the literature and if you look at what the justification for neonicotinoids are, they're presented as this sort of benign alternative to organophosphates as well. And you know, broadly, I think it's right that we have seen decreases in insecticide use overall based on the rise of BT, but there are, you know, there's this one insect in corn country called the western corn rootworm, and the BT trait cannot be expressed in plants at a very strong place, and so it is really hard to control resistance to that particular insect, and that particular insect could bring down BT corn in the Midwest. I think that the companies have strategies of trying to put other genes in there. Maybe they'll work, maybe they won't. But you are seeing in the Midwest that, you know, this incredibly important and damaging insect is coming back with a vengeance. And, you know, the thing is, what you guys are both describing is called the pesticide treadmill. That's what ecologists call it. And there are ways to break it that we know of. And the easiest way to break the pesticide treadmill doesn't involve any kind of, you know, wonder seed coming down the pike that's engineered for another herbicide or anything like that. It involves simple things like crop rotation. Crop rotation developed because it's really good at breaking disease and insect and weed patterns. And simply adding another crop to the rotation in the Midwest instead of just doing corn and soy every year would do wonders to break resistance. And I don't think the pesticide treadmill is sort of something that we live with. It's a sort of consequence of agriculture. I think there are simple, non-toxic ways to get around it.
Let Nate jump in here for a moment so we can get Nate, go ahead.
I mean, I think even rotating away from corn, just going to soy, you know, would be a huge improvement. I mean, most of the places where we have the Western corn borer, Western corn rootworm, I'm sorry, European corn borer is one that's that hasn't gotten any resistance. But most of these places, we have people planting corn on corn on corn. I mean, it's just ridiculously bad stewardship. And you know, the entomologists are saying, look, if you just go to soybeans for 1 year, you're going to starve these guys. But there's been so much money to be made in corn that they haven't done it. You know, even I think Tom's absolutely right that we're on this pesticide treadmill, but I don't think there's a silver bullet. You know, even pests evolve resistance to rotation if you do that in too regular of a way. I think all of these things have to be used in a really holistic manner, that we use toxic chemicals very sparingly and with great consideration, only when we really need to. And I'm completely on board with using other methods like rotation, but it's not a solution. We still will have pests gaining resistance, like, you know, cicadas.
So, Nate, go ahead.
In a basis to take advantage of, they don't emerge every year. So that's an example of an insect that's gained some kind of evolutionary strategy around that. So, I'm completely in favor of these sustainable techniques. I just think that, you know, perhaps we can use things like BT in conjunction sometimes.
But let me ask this question. I think to the heart of the matter for most people who don't know all the intricacies of every herbicide and pesticide that's used and what's there. People just know that things aren't as healthy as they should be for us. The connections we've had on this program before, when we look at pesticide research and what is actually the underlying cause, some people are theorizing around certain cancers and other things. People are very concerned about that in the society, more and more increasingly concerned about all that. So the question I have really about when it comes to genetically modified organisms, GMOs, and the development of GMOs in our food system, whether it's here in this country or in the developing world, which is where some people think it's supposed to be this the way to salvation from low food yield and starvation and not enough food for people who are poor. What's the argument for GMOs? I'm curious from your sense, what will they bring us? Why are you writing about that GMOs were making too much of this? You know, when we look at like Cheerios had to pull back from using certain GMOs in their Cheerios because it seemed like it was a marketplace was telling them, so they stopped. Which means they might not need it in the first place. But you're also saying in that was kind of maybe not even necessary. So talk a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to say too much about it because I don't think that they can, you know, perhaps there'll be some wonderful thing down the pike. But what we have so far, what we have to work with, isn't all that great. You know, I do think that, you know, Tom's right. We've seen a rise in neonic seed treatments, but these are things that are directly on the seeds rather than being sprayed aerially. We've seen a tremendous increase in biodiversity in fields because of BT crops. And you know, it's widely accepted. I think Tom accepts as well that insecticide applications have gone down. So, I mean, that one genetically modified crop, I think, you know, even if it disappears tomorrow, will have been good for the environment. And, you know, I just think that in general, there we probably should be pursuing lots of different areas of innovation. This is just one of them. I wouldn't want to completely cut it off. But I'm not going to argue that there's been a lot of good that's come from it.
So, Tom, I mean, to talk about what good can come from, where you think it doesn't come from then.
Well, like I said before, and I've tried to express in the past, that I think it ends up being a bit of a crude technology that doesn't work for all that much, and that in most cases, traditional plant breeding with a technology called marker-assisted breeding, where they use the genome to identify a few genes in a species, like let's say corn, that may confer drought resistance, and they cross in a line that has those traits. Things like that, I think, end up being a lot cheaper and more effective. I think it's possible that on the margin, there are situations where GE technology has proven promising. An example is this terrible greening, this pathogen that's affecting citrus throughout the world, including in the United States here in Florida, in California. And it's proven to be very difficult. And from people I talk to, it looks like it's no sure thing. It's no silver bullet, but it looks like GM technology offers the best way to control that particular pest. And it won't be a permanent solution because the pathogen is expected to evolve resistance to the technology. But I think what happens a lot, Nate isn't as guilty of this as other people who write about this, that these very marginal things, these things that are like kind of exceptions, like the citrus greening GMO orange, that haven't even come to fruition yet. Like it's not in the field yet. It's still being tested. Like I said, it's emerged as the most promising, but it hasn't worked yet. They are moved from the margin and put at the center. And the technology is all about this kind of thing when really that stuff is marginal. And then you get accused of wanting to starve the world because you're raising questions about it. And I think it just completely skews the debate. I think a more interesting debate isn't are GMOs good or are GMOs bad. A more interesting debate is, you know, what systems of agriculture, what techniques of agriculture do we need to adopt as we move into an era of climate instability with a warming pattern and population growth? And I think when you tease out that debate and think that through, GMOs become very marginal to it. They become like this sideshow that might have some promise here and there, but there are other things that are that, you know, if we figure this out, we will have adopted other things is what I think.
So, Nate, give us a closing thought after what Tom just said before we have to break.
I don't have a lot to add. I think he's basically right. I would just add that, yes, that is a much more interesting debate, I think. You know, this is this one technology that a lot of attention has been focused on. And I agree with him that it doesn't make sense to completely say, let's cut off all research on this technology, because we have challenges to make our food system economically and environmentally sound in the future. And, you know, perhaps it will be helpful in doing that. And perhaps not, in which case we should be clear-eyed about that and not talking about it like it's going to be the one thing that's going to save the world, but also realizing that it's probably not the one thing that's going to sink the world either.
Well, I think this is just the beginning of this conversation. We've talked a lot about GMOs in this program, but we'll continue to talk about it, entering debates in some of the state legislatures and more. And I want to thank both of our guests. This has really been important and just the tip of the iceberg. Nathaniel Johnson, food writer for Grist, teaches at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, wrote the book All Natural, A Skeptic's Quest to Discover If the Natural Approach to Diet, Childbirth, Healing, and the Environment Really Helps Us Healthier and Happier. And Tom Philpott, Mother Jones food and agricultural correspondent, also co-founder of Maverick Farms in North Carolina. Tom and Nate, thank you both so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
We'll take a brief break. Turn, going out, turn. Pete Seeger. He just left us. We'll always have him around.
And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep. To everything, turn, there is a season. Turn, and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together.
Welcome back. This is Mark Stein. You're listening to Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community out of Baltimore, Maryland, and Marlboro Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM on the shore. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on MeQ, Baltimore's credit union's banner at the top of the page. On our continuing conversations here on Soundbites, we are going to now talk about the Eastern Shore and a brand new project taking off called Shore Power. We have with us here Briggs Cunningham. And Briggs, it's good to have you with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Briggs, talk about what happened here, this meeting that I did want to go to and see what was going on. When this took place, you're the energy programs manager at the Center for Environment and Society at Washington College. But what took place that day? What was this huge process that culminated the other day?
Well, we had a ceremonial launch event down in Easton to celebrate the beginning of the Shore Power project. Which is a project that involves four municipalities on Maryland's eastern shore, Cambridge, Easton, Salisbury, and Snow Hill. And what we're trying to do is assist them in reducing energy consumption, reducing expenses for energy, and reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
So, I mean, how does that work literally? I mean, when you started this, when the Center for Environment Society created this partnership, tell me how this happened. When I was reading that your town, Chester Town's electricity consumption dropped by 300,000 kilowatt hours per year.
Yes, sir.
So, how did that happen? And B, what does that really mean?
Well, it started as a collaboration between Town Creek Foundation and the Center for Environment Society here at Washington College, because the college signed on to an agreement to do just the same sort of reductions at the same time that the town signed on to the U.S. Mayor's Climate Protection Agreement, but the town and the college didn't have anybody on staff to help them manage those commitments. So I was hired to help them do that, and part of the commitment is to track energy use on an annual basis and then make recommendations for reducing it.
So how is it reduced? And what does this model say for the rest of us?
Well, you start with conservation. You know, that means just turning off lights, turning down the AC, turning off the computers, making sure everything's off for the weekends.
And who turned them down, by the way? When you say turn them off, who did the turning off?
The town municipal employees.
Uh-huh.
So they get them all involved, and that starts to snowball, and then they can use the savings to make efficient projects come into play, like replacing light bulbs and making your HVAC systems more efficient.
So, were people doing this at work and at home?
Absolutely. We started a residential program as well that that was in line with the municipal program.
I mean, I'm curious. So the savings, or let's say that you extrapolate this out. Let's say the entire town of Chestertown, you add Salisbury and did this experiment together. What would that mean? I mean, go ahead.
What we're hoping to do is get in line with the state's goals of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by 2025. The town of Chestertown has done that by 11% already. So if we can get other municipalities in a regional effort to do it at least by 10% over the next 2 years, we'll be a long way down the road.
Now, I know you're developing this partnership now with four towns and cities: Cambridge, Easton, Salisbury, and Snow Hill.
Correct.
So I'm really curious. I mean, that's why I was asking the question: how you would extrapolate that out? What would that, if you got entire communities and businesses involved? I mean, what would that savings really mean beyond just dollars and cents? What does it mean in terms of the future and our children's future? What would this kind of thing mean?
Well, it means that we'll be turning more toward a region that's using less traditional fossil fuels and more green energy.
Because you're saying the savings can then go into like green energy, whether it's solar or wind or something else?
Absolutely. And when we partner with the state agencies like the Maryland Energy Administration's Smart Energy Communities Program, we can invest in those types of efficient and renewable systems for the for a better and cleaner future.
I mean, if you could think about what this means, let's say over the next 10, 20 years, if the state of Maryland got involved in something like this in a large way, I mean, literally, how would it allow us to kind of move from fossil fuels to things like solar or even wind? But how would it allow us in our communities to move from wind? What would it do for the cost of that, if anything?
Well, with the state investments, it will make it more affordable for the smaller communities that could never, you know, have that kind of investment on their regular budgets. So for small communities like Chestertown and Snow Hill and Cambridge, this becomes a regional effort, and we can bring to bear economies of scale so that they can really get involved in this type of effort.
Because what you've really done in Chestertown is pretty phenomenal when you look at the numbers. I mean, the idea that we could actually begin to move away as a state, as a society, away from fossil fuels to things like solar because of the savings, I mean, that would be a pretty revolutionary change.
It is a revolutionary change, but it's cultural too, Mark, and it's really time for it to happen.
What do you mean it's cultural too?
Well, it's cultural because we used to believe that, you know, energy was free and cheap and easy to come by. Well,
ain't happening now.
You know, the more we drill in America, the less expensive the energy becomes. Well, that's fine, but it's not good for the environment. We need to come up with different solutions.
So, Briggs, could you give us a website people can go to learn more about what you've done?
Yes, please go to shorepowerproject.com. Again, shorepowerproject.com.
And that'll be linked to on our site here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. So we'll continue this conversation more with other communities and see how that's done. We can maybe take that out from Delmarva and even have it in Baltimore as well. Briggs Cunningham has been joining us here on the Soundbites, and Briggs Cunningham is the energy program manager at the Center for Environment and Society at Washington College. Congratulations on this, Briggs. We look forward to having more in-depth conversations. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that, Mark. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
And that's it today for Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show. The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are productions of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva Public Radio, is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and find information about our guests and what they've been talking about on the air with us today, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.